Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The New Statesman.
Hi, I'm Anoush, and on today's episode of the New Statesman podcast, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Jim Down, an intensive care doctor at University College London Hospitals. This year marks the NHS's 75th anniversary, which comes at a crisis point for the health service in this time of strikes and backlogs. But our listeners may know Jim better for his work during the pandemic, from his 2021 book, Life Support, which chronicles his experience on the COVID frontline in an ICU ward. And a New Statesman long read headlined The Peak, documenting one of his night shifts during the height of what was the first COVID wave in April 2020. Now he's bringing out a second book all about life in intensive care called Life in the Balance, out on the 23rd of February. Thanks so much for coming into the studio, Jim.
It was a great pleasure.
Now, before we get into the meat of your book, I should tell our listeners that we are recording this episode in the week of the biggest round of strikes in NHS history. What's the mood at your hospital like at the moment and among your colleagues?
I think we're all pretty unanimously supportive of the nurses and the ambulance workers and potentially, if it comes to it, the junior doctors. I think the feeling is it's been highlighted by the last couple of years being so extreme. I think we all feel that the nurses should be paid better for them and also for the future of the profession. We're already, whatever is it, 40,000 short in this country, and that's only going to get worse unless we look after them, I think.
Okay, and so you'd call on the government to give the pay rises that they're demanding?
Yes, I would. I appreciate that's a very easy thing to say from my position, and there's lots of consequences of that, but I think both in nursing and in junior medical staff, it's the only way we're going to keep them in the profession, and we now know how much we need them. I think everyone knows how much we need them, and I think the shortages are severe. There's lots of reasons for that, which we have been rehearsed a lot, but if you look at junior doctors, for example, it's totally different to when I came out 20, however long ago that was. They come out with £100,000 worth of debt. They're paid poorly. It's years before they can think about moving on with the stage of their lives, and I think that many of them think of just leaving, going to Australia, going to New Zealand, where life looks a lot more attractive.
And so what does that mean if they don't get the pay that they're asking for, and if this situation carries on getting worse? What does it mean for the future of the NHS? Is that something that concerns you?
Oh, absolutely. I think we've seen in the last 12 years, I look back to the New Labour years, and what did we complain about in the NHS? We complained about MRSA, which is still there, and yet you never hear about it now. And that's because at that time, waiting lists were 3 months, 2 months for a hip replacement, and A&E targets, 98% would hit 4-hour targets. It was a totally different time. And whereas we all know what the situation is now. And if we don't get the staff, that won't get better, I don't think.
The government will often say that this is down to the extraordinary circumstances of the pandemic, which, of course, you've written about and worked on firsthand. How much is it down to what COVID did to the NHS in terms of waiting lists, and how much is it down to longer-term factors?
I think it's a mixture. There's no question the pandemic was horrendous, and everything stopped. And I believe rightly. There are bits of what the government did that I would criticise, but generally I think lockdowns were necessary, awful, but necessary. I think the move to focusing on the pandemic, particularly in that first surge, was unavoidable. It was, if you were there, it was awful. And there was no other way to deal with it. It was new, the scale was unimaginable, and we had to focus on it. I know people say it affected older people, and it took 10 years off people's lives, the people who died. So that's an it was huge. But that's had a massive impact, of course, and waiting lists have gone up. But also, if you look at the last sort of 10, 12 years, the funding has not kept up with inflation, and I think it's been building over that time, really.
How much does it affect your area of the hospital, these backlogs and the waiting lists and what you've just been describing?
It's interesting. It doesn't affect my work, per se, except for staffing on a daily basis. I suppose the biggest effect to me personally is that if we've got gaps on our junior doctor rota or nursing shifts unfilled, then it's much more difficult to run the day. And what inevitably happens is that elective work gets cancelled. So part of the intensive care is taking surgery, you know, really major surgery that needs to come to intensive care for a night or two afterwards. And if we haven't got the staff to cover, that's the bit that gets delayed,
right?
Because you can't not take emergencies. So that's where we sit. So that's our big sort of daily struggle, is to keep that flow going. And of course, the patients feel it the most when they come in on that day when they're all geared up to have their big cancer operation. It's put off. It's awful.
Do you notice what the waiting lists are doing to people in terms of making them sicker? Are you getting patients in who perhaps wouldn't have been in ICU if they'd been seen on time?
So I can't give you hard data on that. I know there was a very odd thing in the first wave where people stayed at home.
Yeah.
And I think quite a lot of people died at home because they didn't feel they should go to hospital, either because they didn't want to burden it or because they were worried about catching COVID. So I'm sure there is a knock-on effect of that. And I think also if you delay surgery, if you're waiting for a hip replacement, you can't walk. If you wait another year, you know, the effects of not walking for a year are not good for you. You're less fit, you're less able to come through your surgeries. It definitely has an impact.
And in your book, there are some headline-grabbing cases. In your book, Alexander Litvinenko admitted to your ward, the aftermath of the 7/7 terrorist attacks, and a scene at a train crash where you actually go to the scene after a train has derailed. But a great deal of your work is also more of the sort of mundane struggle to find beds. How do you balance those two? The great drama, I think, that comes with ICU, but also these features of the system failures that you've just been running me through.
Yeah, I mean, so that's, I really wanted to put that in because I think people, the sort of perception from TV dramas of ICU is it's about the, will they make it, won't they make it, the sort of beeping monitor. And it's either all great or catastrophe. But actually, of course, ICU, a lot of it is that daily struggle for beds. And I really wanted to try, that takes up a huge amount of all of our time, trying to work out what we can do, what we should do, how you should use the resource, how things are going to develop over the day, because you're constantly balancing emergencies with electives. And then all the nuance about, are we doing the right thing by this person by putting them through days and days of, or weeks and weeks of intensive care? Is the potential benefit worth the burden? I suppose a lot of jobs, most of it is those sort of nuanced, complex things. And then you have something like a pandemic or a train crash or a Russian spy that it did changes the pace a bit.
Yeah. And how has the struggle for beds got worse over the course of your career? You mentioned the new Labour years being easier.
Yes.
Has that always been a part of it?
It's always been there, and it's worse every winter, of course, and that's the eternal struggle or problem. I think it's got worse. There's lots of factors, aren't there? The population's changing, people are living longer, all those kind of things. There are some good factors as well. Smoking is clearly far less than it was when I was a junior doctor in the 90s, and so that's great. And maybe if we could do the same thing with ultra-processed foods, and then that would be a huge thing. So there are things going in the right direction, but I think the combination of a changing population and the reduced sort of relative funding has made it worse, definitely.
Right, okay. And we always want to talk about solutions on the NHS podcast, and you have some ideas. You write about the postcode lottery of healthcare in this country, and one of your ideas is to pair up thriving hospitals with failing hospitals.
I'm going to get in a lot of trouble for this at work, because I know it was put forward as an idea a few years ago, I think maybe by Margaret Hodge, and because there is a problem with the whole... So the one thing I don't agree with New Labour on this was this idea that the sort of business competitive thing. I think there's a place for that, but you have to be really careful with it because it's not a business. And who suffers if a place isn't doing well and isn't getting rewarded? The people who live there, not the people who work there. The people who work there might get demoted or something, but the people who live there, the patients suffer.
Yes, yes.
So I think, and there will always be centres of excellence that will attract people, and it'll be a sort of a virtuous circle. When we're training, we go around all the hospitals, so you see everything. And I think maybe we should pair up the ones that are struggling with ones that are thriving, and to try and eradicate that postcode lottery as much as we can. I'm not claiming that we can have nirvana, but I think... I do think that is something that we could look at.
And what would that look like, sharing?
I'm going to be in so much trouble. But you could, there are hospitals that have taken over by other hospitals if they're failing, and you could make them one trust, and then you all thrive or fail as one group. So then there's an incentive for the more successful hospital to ensure that the other one performs better, as it were. And I think it would be complex, but I think it's certainly worth a look. I think people always talk about money and reform, and I'm sure that's right, but it feels that you've got to be very careful with the reform, I think, so that you don't have unintended consequences.
That's interesting, because a couple of former health secretaries, Ken Clark and Sajid Javid, have suggested that people who are higher paid at least should pay something for a GP appointment or a minor procedure. How do you feel about that kind of direction for reform?
Mixed about. I think there's a thing about the NHS, when it's working well, it's brilliant. And I think there's a lot of advantages to it being free at the point of use. And I think there's a lot of advantages to the staff in it not being incentivized by what they do. If you compare with America, where you get paid for doing a thing.
Yeah.
Then, and I like the fact that the consultant tiers are essentially is a flat thing. Mm-hmm. Everyone's paid to go and do their job. And that means that they don't have an incentive to do particular things because they'll get paid more. Now, you could say there's a disadvantage because that doesn't breed efficiency and things. But I think overall, I'd rather that than the American system. And I also think personally, don't necessarily think the way we pay for it is. I think I'm very happy to pay for it out of taxation. I don't mind paying more tax for it, but I don't think there's a problem with the free at the point of use. I get the argument that people shouldn't use it irresponsibly, but I really think the thing is you need to have the money and the governance of it, you know, wherever that comes from. And I'm happy to do it through taxation, to be honest.
Hi, it's Anoush here. This is just a reminder that as a podcast listener, you have the option of subscribing to The New Statesman with a very special offer. You can subscribe for just £1 a week. That's 12 weeks for £12 if you go to newstatesman.com/podcast offer. We'll be right back.
If you enjoy the New Statesman podcast, then you'll love our daily politics newsletter, Morning Call. It's a quick, essential guide to the big political story each morning by me, Freddie Hayward, and Rachel Wearmouth, featuring original reporting from Westminster and beyond, our analysis of the latest political news, and some recommendations of the best reads of the day. Sign up for free at the link in the podcast description.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
About yourself, intensive care is the section of hospital with the sickest patients, and you have to make these snap decisions that can affect people's lives so often. And you described yourself in the book more than once, I think, as risk averse. Why did you choose that area of medicine?
it is a bit counterintuitive. The first thing is, I think medicine, if you do, has risks. I have huge respect for GPs in that they have this job of constantly assessing the risk of, is this something serious or they do that, whatever it is, 30 times a day in a very short period of time, knowing that you can't get away from the fact that something could be wrong. Now, they have safety nets and systems and bring people back. But I would find that really stressful. I'd want to scan everyone from head to foot. And
love you.
Yes, but the taxpayer wouldn't. So there's a time scale about that. So there'd be the one that niggled in my head and I'd be thinking about it all week. Whereas in intensive care and anaesthesia, which I also do, it's immediate. So I can, so usually at the end of the day, I can see what the effects of what I've done. It happens in real time, and that suits me well. The risk thing, though, I spent a lot of time trying to rationalize the risk, and really only recently, as I talk about in the book, towards the end, it's only in the last couple of years that I've really faced up to it and accepted that you can't eradicate risk, and you have to learn to live with it.
Yeah.
And that's quite, I don't know if it'll make me a better doctor, but it's bizarre that it took me so long to accept it, if you like.
Really interesting, that journey, because you write of some of your early experiences in a hospital and you look at the ICU doctors and you think, God, they're so confident, they know what they're doing, they're unflappable, their word is the sort of gold standard. And you think that in time you'll become like that. You say you'll become confident and wiser, but actually you say you've become more risk averse and more anxious, and actually your imposter syndrome has become more acute.
Yeah, I think it was quite common, actually. So I went through a period of feeling peaked in confidence, if you like. And then there's a couple of things that happen, I think. One is that as you get older, you relate to patients more closely. So more of them are your age, and so you feel more vulnerable. And the decisions you make feel more personal in a way, because you put yourself in their shoes, which is a good thing in lots of ways, but also can make decisions more difficult. And I think a lot of people towards the latter end of their career start to find the decisions more difficult for that reason. And so your objectivity goes a bit. And the more you've seen, the more you've been surprised. And that in some ways is not helpful. So it's interesting. The more you know, the less you know, in a way.
Yes. And it's about embracing that uncertainty that you mentioned.
Yeah. So I talk about, when I was having a bad time, someone really put their finger on it and said, how do you deal with uncertainty? And that really made me think, that's what I've got. That's the problem. And we all have to deal with it, don't we? But I was doing that thing of Baldrick writing his name on a bullet so he couldn't be shot. So then he had the bullet with his name on it.
And you make a really striking point in the book that anaesthetists, many of whom are ICU doctors like you, they have a shorter life expectancy than other doctors. Mm. Why do you think that is? And why did that stat strike you?
It's an interesting, that stat is a sort of, I'm not saying that's completely hard data, but there is data to suggest that. And I think it's an odd job because it's got this sort of combination of high responsibility but low control. When we put someone to sleep, they're completely our responsibility and you have to take over their vital functions. And that's almost always absolutely fine. So I don't want to put anyone off having an anaesthetic, but it's odd because for two reasons. One is you're not the person who makes them better, but you can make them a lot worse. And two, you're not the one who's really made the decision for them to be there. Now, with more complex patients, we do get involved in that decision more and more. But traditionally, the surgeon books them for a case and then you take them on. And obviously, some people are very straightforward to anaesthetize and others aren't. So you've got this gap between control and responsibility. And people talk about that as a high stress, a stressful thing to have. So there's that. There's also this issue that the better you are at it, the more invisible you become, which is an odd thing, and that's why people become anaesthetists, I think, because they're not showy people, but we're always quoted that 50% of the country don't realise that they're medically trained, all that kind of thing.
Oh, really?
So it's an odd job in that way. And then the final tragic thing is that, of course, anaesthetists have access to drugs. Through my career, I've known of a few people who've taken their own lives. Anaesthetists do it very quietly and effectively, and it's awful. So I think, it's a mixture of factors.
Yes, and you do write about how your own mental health has been affected by your work. You talk a little bit about your experience with that.
Yeah, so I think COVID affected us all. Initially in that sort of extraordinary sort of camaraderie way, came in and got on with it. And in some ways, it was easier for us because we had a job and you knew what you were meant to do. But by the end of that sort of year and a bit, of the first two big waves, we were all a bit shell-shocked by the scale of what had happened, really.
Yeah.
And many of us were haunted by all the patients we'd seen. And I came out of it and then I had a case that was upsetting and that just was the straw that broke the camel's back, I think, and I decompensated. And it felt very acute. It felt like it had happened just after that thing. But looking back, it's clear that it was lots and lots of things. And I got into a sort of anxiety, depression spiral. And I had two lucky things. One was that by being here, I'm a massive oversharer. So I didn't shut up about it, as some people do. I told everyone and bored everyone to death. And the other thing was that although I felt dreadful, I didn't ever not want to get better. I didn't get into that feeling of, I want to just stop here. So I was lucky, and I was also lucky in that had amazing support, work from our psychological service through a thing called Practitioners Health, which is there for all medical staff. And then I became a cliche and started jumping in the Lido like everyone else.
Oh, yes, the cold swimming.
I know.
Cure.
Yes, but it was incredibly helpful to me because it was the first. I never dreamt I'd do it, and someone suggested it. And the first time I got in the water, it just completely cleared my head because I couldn't think of anything apart from how cold it was.
And you go all year round, don't you?
Yeah, I still go. Yeah, 5 degrees this morning.
Oh wow. Okay.
Yeah, it's cold. But it's not. One of the things I like about it is it's the people there. It's not at all. There's no machismo or just a bunch of
chilly men.
Yeah, chilly and women. But yeah, chilly the elderly men who talk nonsense. Shiver.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because during the pandemic, there was a lot of talk of this idea of rationing healthcare, but actually that is something that you have to do every day when you decide who does and doesn't get an ICU bed, because as you write, it's not a very nice experience being there.
Yeah, I think my personal view on this is that rationing is there. For rationing not to be there, we'd have to have an endless budget. All the time we're rationing. So if a new drug comes out, they do a cost-benefit analysis and decide whether to make it available on the NHS or not. That's rationing, isn't it? And I think no one likes to talk about it. And I suppose my caveat would be we don't ration emergency care. I think the NHS has always been and still is really brilliant if you're acutely sick. And I suppose that's one of the reasons I would defend it to the hilt. And I'd be against, on principle, against privatisation, because I think picking off the easy bits and leaving that hard bit to the NHS is a real, really frightens me.
Yeah.
The NHS is what picks up the problems from the private sector often. So if things go wrong in the private sector, it's very common to end up in the NHS. Not always, and I'm not having a go at the private sector, but it offers those hard yards. And I think it's brilliant for that. If you're hip replacement, you wait a year for you, that's rationing, isn't it? That's because you'd be better served getting it done in a month. And if that's a form of, if you've got cancer and it's delayed, that's... But yeah, I think we have to face that. The difficult thing about that is it'll always be there, but also the decisions we make about it are so difficult.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm trying to get at in that beds chapter is it seems the obvious that you delay the person having bariatric surgery, say, but of course then they will get all sorts of problems by being delayed and they're on a pathway and... So I don't think the point I come out with at the end is that it's not straightforward how to ration it.
Yeah, that's a really interesting part of the book it's a theme that runs through the book, is the sort of the weight of those ethical decisions and how you reconcile those each and every day.
Yeah, or try to.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right, I think that's all we want to ask, but thank you so much for coming on to the podcast. It was great to have you, and I'm sure our listeners have learned a lot about the inner workings of these sometimes mysterious parts of the hospital that hopefully have to use.
Well, no one really wants to know about it unless they have to go there, but I thought, hopefully they'll want to read about it.
Yes, hopefully. And the book is Life in the Balance, and it's out on the 23rd of February.
Thanks so much.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Anusha Kellyan, and my guest, Dr. Jim Down. We're produced by Adrian Bradley, and our music is Devil with the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons. Thanks so much for listening, and don't forget to leave us a nice review and subscribe.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.